And good morning. It is coffee time. Coffee with the Radio Ranch Wranglers here on the Scriptures for America Worldwide Broadcasting Network. It is May 3rd, 2025. We welcome you folks out there. We'll be right back after this song.
Like cattle through our fantasies and fears. They move us through illusion and confusion of the mind, and by changing subtle meanings to the words between the lines. It's the news behind the news and the methods you can use. It's a blueprint and the plan they all rely on. And it's written in the protocols, the learned elders of Zion. They'll tell you it's a forgery, they'll tell you it's a fake, that some anti-Semite wrote it for the money that he'd make. It's been slanderized and demonized and labeled racist hate by the same who stake a claim to its creation. Now I'm not here to try to argue if it's false or if it's true, if the author was a commie or the likes of you know who. What I'm really trying to tell you and to get across to you is it's a blueprint to the downfall of our nation. To the chaos that's occurring in the land, there's a road to communism, there's a global master plan. You'll never read about it in a book of history, cause it's been hidden from the masses to control their destiny. It's the news behind the news and the methods that they use. It's the blueprint and the plan they all rely on. And it's written in the protocols of the learned elders of Zion. So if you ever get a chance to get a copy of your own, just remember not to ever leave it lying around your home. Cause you never know just where their snoopy news reporters roam. One might even be a friend or close relation. It's the cause to the chaos that's occurring in the land. It's the source of communism. It's the global master plan. You'll never read about it in a book of history, cause it's been hidden from the masses to control our destiny. Behind the news and the methods that they use, it's a blueprint and the plan they all rely on. And it's written in the protocols of the learned elders of Zion. And it's written in the protocols of the learned elders of Zion.
And we're back, and you're listening to Coffee with the Radio Ranch Wranglers here on the SFAWBN, May 3rd, 2025. And I'll bring the men on the line. Good morning, Tim.
Good morning.
And good morning, Will.
Good morning.
And thank you for being here, men. Tim, why don't you start us off with a word of prayer this morning, if you would, please, sir.
All right. Dear Lord and Heavenly Father, we just come before you this morning thanking you, Lord, for another opportunity to serve you and to be of use to you, Lord. And we just pray that you would anoint this broadcast this morning, your Holy Spirit, Lord, that you would filter our words, Lord, that you would grant us your wisdom and your knowledge, that we might be a benefit to your people, Lord, and a blessing to them, Lord, and that we might call out and see the deceptions in the land, Lord, and that we might be given to understand as a people how we can best benefit in our salvation and our Christianity through these things, Lord, and that we might just be drawn closer to you through all this, Lord, that many would come to your knowledge and saving grace. We know, Lord, that you delay for that one or those few that are still there. Lord, we pray that even now their minds would be open and their ears would be unstopped and their eyes would see, and Lord, that they would come before you and come to you, Lord, with whatever is necessary for their redemption. We pray for the families across this land, Lord, that suffer need and peril, Lord, in your name, that they would be comforted, and Lord, that they would be lifted up. We ask that you bless the work of our hands, that you bless our minds with strength and clarity, and Lord, that you grant us every good thing. In the name of Jesus Christ, by his blood we pray it. Amen.
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 Thank you, Tim. Well, before we get started with the program this morning, I just wanted to say a couple of things, and that is today is May 3rd, 2025, and that means that it's my baby girl's 18th birthday, and 18 years ago. I know that I've had a couple of people that have reached out to me recently and asked about baby Rachel. Baby Rachel was, she was the girl that was, she was basically held captive by a hospital. And, it was a long battle. She was pronounced dead at the hospital and started crying. And the remnant started praying. And there was prayers that were just heard around the world for my daughter, and she is doing fantastic. She is she's alive, she's well, and the Lord just really gave us a miracle. He gave us miracle after miracle, and I don't know if there's people out there that are still listening to us that made the phone calls, but it was during one of our battles. They wanted to do an operation that I didn't want done, and they got a court order to do it anyway, and it led to a tremendous court battle. It led to basically the roar of the remnant shutting the Children's Hospital phone bank down and saying no, and asking why are you trying to do this? And that led to a court battle and to be called into court the next day and to be detained by a couple of thugs with guns. Me and Pastor Peters both were. And it was a learning experience, a humbling experience. And just something that we're just so thankful for, the roar of the remnant that stood up and stood with us and fought a good fight. And but wanted to tell people about that. That was she was born 18 years ago, and I'm very thankful for the remnant that was out there that supported us in that battle. And the Lord used a lot of different people from a lot of different parts of the world. We were getting calls in from New Zealand, Nicaragua, South Africa, all over the world, and just very, very thankful for that and for the assistance in that fight. And just wanted to give people an update on that. That was something that it's like 18 years ago, and it seems like it was yesterday. But Lord delivered us, and that was good. But I wanted to get that out there. We're going to go ahead and move on. And One of the things that I think is definitely worth starting off with is the headline, Israel hit with the largest ever wildfires. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu declares a national emergency over the situation. Israeli firefighters continue to battle wildfires that have been raging near Jerusalem for 2 days. Emergency services have described them as some of the largest ever in the country's history. That's huge.
Yeah. I don't even equate wildfires with Israel. You know, I don't recall ever hearing that before. Do y'all ever remember hearing that in the headlines?
No. And I did a quick search about fires over there, and it's a rare deal. I mean, a small fire, and that's about it. I couldn't find anything on any large fires ever hitting Israel.
Yeah, and one of these is at the Canada Park, which is, I guess, maybe a forestry or a forest area over there or something. But I did think it was interesting that they had, like, 12 people injured or something like that, or 12 civilians and 17 firefighters have been, you know, hospitalized due to smoke inhalation and burns. And I didn't have time to look that up, but I was kind of curious about not that I want to see anybody burned or injured, but does that seem like a kind of a low number to you for a big fire? I mean, or in an area?
It seems low to me when you think about the size of the state of Israel. You know, it's not a huge country, so it's not like the wildfires that we see, you know, raging through the West, where it's a lot of open country and not a lot of people. They're very centralized there. You know, as far as their population, it's very centered up, and they're very close together. So to have this massive, you know, multi-thousand acre fire, knowing that they're very closely, they're densely populated there, it does seem like a low number, Tim, to me. It sure does.
Well, yeah, and they got over 160 firefighters on it, 12 aircraft on it, and to have 12 aircraft on a fire is huge. We've had 1,000 huge, big fires around here, and that's what, I mean, we get them every, you know, if not every year, every couple of years around here in this area. And to have that many aircraft on a fire, usually if you get the aircraft like that on there, it's out within 30 minutes. It's they're dropping a lot of water, a lot of chemicals on it, whatever they're using. So, it's, you know, let's get in there and knock this thing out.
Let me throw this out just because of what we were talking about, you know, that this isn't a reoccurring thing. It's not the West, the U.S. West or the Canadian West, that, you know, there's a fire season. You know, this is coming. You pre-position those firefighting aircraft. This doesn't happen in Israel. Where in the world did they come up with 12 firefighting aircraft?
Yeah,
exactly.
Good
yeah.
point.
And be able to summon that very quickly, you know, and that leads into, I was reading up on this, and depending on the news source, depending on who you want to believe, there's either three folks in custody for arson or 18, up to 18 is what I've read. And what I was reading this morning about this is that they're saying that this is Hamas, which is the Israeli boogeyman over there, that this is revenge for the massacre at Port Bandar Abbas, which was a Mossad operation, and the Iranians are responsible for this. So I know there's a lot of war drums that have been beat over there here in the recent months, and just recently Trump was talking about Netanyahu is not going to pull the United States into a war with Iran. And it sure seems like that's what Israel wants, is a war with Iran. And I just thought this was convenient that you have, you know, this large fire in a place that doesn't have fires. You have 12 aircraft that are pre-positioned, ready to fight the fire. And in the matter of a day, you have 3 to 18 people under arrest, and you're pointing the fingers and saying this is all from Iran. That just seems suspicious to me. I don't know about y'all. It's very convenient. There you go, Tim. Very convenient. You know, what greater way to drum up support than to create your own emergency? I don't know. Maybe I'm off base on that.
I don't think you're off base at all. I think that it is. That's what I thought too. Is convenient. It's like, interesting. How convenient. Well, let's have a fire. But then also, you know, it's one of the scriptures that we've brought up, and it's actually we brought it up quite a bit lately, over the last couple of months, several times, and it's found in Obadiah 1:18, and it says, quote, "The house of Jacob will be a fire and the house of Joseph a flame, but the house of Esau will be like stubble, and they will set them on fire and consume them so that there will be no survivor of the house of Esau, for the Lord has spoken." You know, could it be prophecy being fulfilled?
I'll tell you what, Jason, I don't know if it was the Iranians or Hamas or if they said it themselves or if it was just a pure accident, but the fact of the matter is the Edomites are on fire.
Yes, they are.
Yep. So, I mean, it seems like that's at least a little bit of prophecy being fulfilled.
I think so. I think it is. And that, you know, that is encouraging, and I pray for that day when Esau is consumed and burned and destroyed and the stubble's gone. It's like praise the Lord. So I'll leave it at that. You know, there's so many things that are going on. You know, fires there, war, power outages, Spain, Portugal, France. All these different cities, and it was interesting that from what I seen, and I had several people send me things, information on this, and from what I gather, correct me if I'm wrong, but it's due to all the solar technology and the solar power that that they've been using over there.
Yeah, the green energy turned to black. It was a massive blackout. So,
it basically, it's go ahead, Will.
No, you go ahead, Tim.
I think it's interesting that, you know, I do a lot of mechanic stuff, and I think it's interesting that all these stories I read, and I'm reading stories from outside the United States, like, you know, out of France and different places, but they're like, well, we'll have the power back on in, you know, 8 to 12 hours. And then in the next breath, they're saying, we don't have any idea what caused it. You know, we still don't understand what's went on. We just recently turned over to all green energy, you know, and everything. And I was sitting there and I was like, you know, when something comes in and it doesn't run or it doesn't work, it's pretty tough for me to fix it if I don't know what's causing the problem. You know, I mean, it's like, these things are, there's an outline or a step-by-step process you have to use to repair anything. And the first thing is, you got to know what's broke, you know, so, and I just read one this morning that said that power's returned to Spain and Portugal on Tuesday after major blackout disrupted flights, metros, and communications across the two countries. And authorities were saying over 99% of the energy demand was restored, but Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez announced an investigation to determine the cause of the outage, which remains unclear. So, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, if you want to fix a problem, you got to kind of know what the problem is or where it's coming from. So they've got these huge power outages, and it's like, okay, we're going to fix it, but we don't know what's wrong. And okay, good luck with that one, guys.
I don't know if y'all read the same thing, but it seems like Portugal and I think Spain as well, not all of France, but Portugal and Spain, recently their entire power grid went to green energy. Did y'all read that as well?
I did.
That is solar and wind and whatever fairy dust energy they're trying to produce. And, you know, I'm not trying to make hydro. There you go. I'm not trying to make light of it. But I read that and I thought, well, there's your problem. That's what happened is, you know, that's not a reliable source of energy. It's a good backup. I have no issues with that. As a matter of fact, I advocate having good solar backups and good wind backups, but it doesn't replace a robust, proven energy grid. And I think this is, on the world stage, a great example of that, that it's just not reliable.
No, it's not. And a reliable source of backup energy is, and I guess I'm just old school, but diesel and diesel generators are, you know, hands down is what I like. I mean, and even gasoline generators, they work really well. I like that for backup power. I would not want to rely completely on solar by any means. And I guess that's just, I know that there's the technology has come a long ways, but it's, yeah. I think it's got a long way to go.
You certainly shouldn't put your eggs in those baskets. That's for sure.
Well, exactly. Especially a country that's putting all their eggs in that basket.
No,
I mean,
kidding.
You know, and I mean, usually so, and it's what I've seen, and I can't remember if it was Portugal or Spain, but I mean, I read one article and it was as soon as they got this thing up and online and they started producing power, they were tearing down their power plant. And it's like, oh, yeah. I mean, it's like, come on. I mean, that's just, to me, there's got to be an enemy behind that. And that's just, I mean, sabotage and sabotage in a country. That's the way that I look at it. That bad idea. I mean, at the, you know, bad idea. I mean, come on, let's get this thing up and running. I mean, talk about redundancy. It's like, you know, you get this thing up and running. It's like, why not have that power plant sitting there ready to go, ready to flip the switch to, you know, to switch back over to it if it doesn't work in cases, you know, in case they can't figure something out. I mean, it just, to me, that would make sense. But I guess common sense ain't real common anymore.
I think you're right, Jason, as far as enemies. But a lot of times, you know, especially think about in light of our country, the enemies are from within.
Yes.
And it's not a foreign enemy that's doing that. It's the own government that's, you know, passing whatever law or rule saying that those traditional, whether it's coal powered or diesel powered or whatever, that, you know, you have to take those online and mothball them so that they can't be used. And I mean, that's the enemy from within.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
and the other part of the redundancy is you know, that grid is set up at 200 or 300% overage rate, so that because that allows for future growth, that allows for extreme circumstances like what, heat waves or super cold fronts or different things like that. And yeah, when you take all the coal, natural gas, diesel, nuclear power plants out of the loop, you're left. What if the sun doesn't shine? What if the wind doesn't blow? What if you know, I mean, where's it come from? Just going to open a can of power and dump it in the grid? So,
definitely. Well, and people do a lot of crazy things when the power's out, too. I mean, you got to think about it, and I don't know what the weather is like over there right now, but, I mean, it's in the summer times, there's a lot of places that you get the air conditioning gets shut off for a long period of time, and people are dying. And yeah. You know, people, you know, if they don't have their power and not sitting in front of the TV, then they're going to be rioting, causing chaos, something like that. Kind of like what's going on over in China right now. I guess that they are just up in arms and riots are taking place. Factories are collapsing under Trump's tariffs. And that's what's bringing the people to the streets. I'm not sure exactly what the gist of that is. Do any of you guys have any idea on what's going on over there with that?
I know
just that they've got a lot of layoffs. Go ahead.
Yes. No, that's right. What Tim was just saying, that the tariffs, and I mean, I guess we have to have maybe a bigger discussion of what really is the purpose of the tariffs. And, you know, we've seen China grow into this just massive giant economically and really become a world power in the last 80 years or so. And it seems like over just the last 100 days, 80 days, their economy really is being hit. It's not being reported widely, at least as of now, in our country at least. But I don't know the real purpose. I don't pretend to know the real purpose of these tariffs as far as what Trump and his administration is doing. But if it's economic warfare, it sure seems like it's working because, like Tim was just saying, there's massive layoffs, tens of thousands of people in China, which is not relatively a huge number in China, but it's just the beginning of this, of these plants, these, you know, sweatshops that were making all of these little trinkets that were getting imported to the United States. They're shuttering their doors. They're just simply shuttering their doors. They can't make payroll. I just came across this morning, and I'm not super familiar with this, and maybe y'all are, but there's an online retailer called Temu, T-E-M-U.
Yep.
And the best thing I can come up with is it's like Harbor Freight for everything. Kitchen gas, I mean, just anything you can imagine, they sell directly from China to the American market. I came across this just a little while ago that it says TMU halts shipping direct from China as tariff loophole is cut off. And it was a tariff loophole called the de minimis tariff. And pretty much what that said was since 2016, anything worth $800 or below could enter the United States duty free. Well, Friday at 12:01 a.m., that ended with an executive order. And now it doesn't matter if it's a $1.50 garlic press coming from China, there's a 145% tariff put on it. And TMU has now halted all shipping from China into the United States. And they've gone, I mean, and this was a matter of a day. I mean, when the loophole was cut off, they said, we're not importing anything else to the United States. And in this article that I was reading on CNBC, it was talking about they're going to reorient their business model and do more business using U.S. producers and U.S. warehouses. And I'm sitting here, you know, Jason, you're talking about these riots in China because people are being laid off. Well, it's kind of what Trump said would happen, that you know, these people are losing their jobs. But according to this article, there's going to be more jobs in the United States of warehousemen and forklift drivers and, you know, delivery operations, that TMU is still going to stay in business. They're just not sending stuff from China. Maybe I'm looking at that wrong. I don't know about y'all. But,
no, I agree 100%.
It seems like it's worked.
Yeah, I heard the same thing. So I heard yesterday that these TMU ships, these cargo container ships coming over from China, were just stopped. They were headed for the United States, and they stopped. They were trying to decide if they were turning around, what they were doing. They were going to try to do some negotiations. We'll see what happens there. But I also heard the same thing that, you know, people are looking out. People decided, hey, let's start looking and seeing what we can buy made in America. And, you know, awesome. Good idea. You know, let's do that. I mean, I've been one of these guys that I've been trying. I try to buy made in America any chance that I get, you know, and I look for stuff. I mean, I look for, you know, whether it's auto parts or, you know, you're shopping, it's like, you know, where is it made? I would much rather pay more and buy something made in America if I have that option. And yeah. I think that it's going to be interesting because, I mean, you know, hopefully we get to the point where, yeah, it is the option, and it's buyer friendly as far as price goes because of, you know, maybe because of these tariffs. It's going to force people to, you know, factories and stuff to open back up, and for, you know, it not to be cheaper to import something. Which, who knows, with the prices, it still might, even with 145% tariffs on something that's, you know, $2.99, there's going to be a lot of stuff that's still going to be produced overseas.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and Goldman Sachs estimates that there would be that this whole thing could lose up to 16 million Chinese jobs. Now, those people aren't so much, I think, transportation workers and that kind of thing. This is what we would call, in our country at least, skilled workers. You know what I mean, as far as people that actually build things, put things together, whether, you know, and I think that those 16 million jobs that are going to be displaced over there, they're not going to disappear because those products are still needed. So coming soon to home, you know, there's the possibility of, I think we're a little more efficient perhaps here, but, you know, that's a lot of jobs coming into our country. And
and they're talking about a lot of, you know, that 16 million too. I mean, you got to think about how many of those are, you know, 9, 10, 12 year old kids that are sitting around in a factory smoking cigarettes. I mean, that's, you know, what, and people, you know, they don't like to think about it, but that's what's happening over there. And that's what they're doing.
Yep.
It's slave labor.
Yeah. It's slave labor,
And they're paid nothing, I mean, basically. Go ahead.
Yeah. No, I was just going to say, I have, this is just me supposing out loud, it would be nice if this administration would now, you know, since it appears this is working, and I'm in total agreement that these 16 million jobs, the need isn't going away. know, it has to relocate somewhere. I would sure like to see this administration start giving tax breaks and tax incentives for American-made manufacturing companies to, you know, knock them off balls and reopen the doors and bring in American skilled workers to do those jobs. Because if you want the economic engine to rev up again, to me, it's just like spraying ether in, right? You want that engine to start. And I think that would be a huge, huge boon to the economy is, you know, let's go the next mile now and start making it economically advantageous to American companies to start producing again. And prayerfully, I mean, maybe that's what they will do. Time will tell. But it's certainly, you know, we're all supposing and giving our opinions. Every day that passes, I become more and more convinced that there is a real thought out written plan from this administration. And they have put it, they're not flying by the seat of their pants. I think they have plotted this out and it seems to be working.
Yep. I would agree. Yes.
Well, and the advantage to that is, and of course, that's been the call to arms with the fact of rejuvenating our industrial sector or our production sector, is the fact of, well, you know, where's the capital outlay going to come from? And I think that reducing the regulatory and the tax overburden on that allows a lot of people tend to look at these huge corporations as the necessity of all this stuff. And I think that the thing that locks out private individuals or entrepreneurs from doing that is a regulatory and tax overburden. They can't swing it. You know, I mean, we're at a point in this country where if you have a small business, you know, you can't hire one person or two people and actually gain any ground because you've got to hire 8 people or 10 people. But if you reduce that regulatory burden, that allows these small companies to become suddenly very competitive, and they're very flexible in the demand and production and development stages. They just need to be left alone so that they can do that. You know, I think that's Amen. That's part of the answer to that.
Well, and I hope that, you know, there's a lot of things that have shifted just over the last 10, 20 years and went over to, you know, we're talking about China right now, but I mean, Vietnam, South Korea, I mean, all these different places, there's been, you know, clothing manufacturing, people that are manufacturing tents. Yeah, I mean, it's really hard to find clothing that's made in the USA anymore. And generally, if you can find it, you're going to pay more for it. And it generally is going to be better quality. I mean, I give you that, but you're going to pay, you know, drastically a lot more for it. I know that, you know, like the Duluth Trading Company, I used to buy stuff from them, and they're used to, you know, pride themselves on everything was made in America in their catalog. And my brother got some stuff from him not too long ago, and I was talking with him, and he's like, yeah, it was made in Korea or something like that. And I called him and actually asked him, and I said, hey, when did this change? And they said, well, we've got 2 catalogs now. We've got a catalog with Made in America products, and then we've got a catalog. But you gotta read the fine print on the front of the covers, I guess, because you know, to me, that was kind of a cheap shot as far as marketing, because I would much rather just shop from the Made in USA catalog if I can afford it. You know, they had to come up and, you know, have their regular catalog with stuff that's made globally. And anyway, it was I thought it was interesting. But I've seen a lot of these, you know. I mean, all the textiles and stuff like that, there's a lot of stuff that's shifted back over to overseas, but they're talking about opening these textile factories back up down in, you know, North Carolina, around that area. I know that there's a big push to get some of that equipment up and running, factories opening up. What can they build? What can they make? How can they make it? To me, that is definitely a good thing, bringing those industries back here to, you know, a lot of them where they started before it was the, you know, child labor that really got, you know, got to where it assisted in making these products cheaper. And, cheaper to purchase. And you know, that's one of the things people don't talk about, that it's, you know, us and them, but that's what it is it's child labors where, you know, people are getting pennies an hour or, you know, dollars a day to, you know, to sweat in a sweatshop for 12 hours. Yet that's what makes your tennis shoes so cheap.
Jason, I wanted to say one thing real fast, just because you mentioned North Carolina. I read the same thing you read as far as the textiles. And I also, it came across the desk that I was reading that also in Western North Carolina, they're knocking the dust off of the furniture factory again, because a tremendous amount of furniture that comes into this country, even under the same names of Ashley and Lane or Broyhill or whatever, it's all Chinese made.
Right.
It's just coming from China and it's coming into the United States. Well, it sounds like, in preparation for what's that's coming, that's already here, these companies are actually retooling and spooling up, these furniture factories again in Western North Carolina. And I think that's awesome, but it's not just for the sake of it's coming back to America. Let's not forget, you know, it's not too far out of our memories, hopefully, that the devastation that came to Western North Carolina and really all of North Carolina there in Appalachia, of the tremendous amount of flooding. And there are people that have been out of work for a year, that their jobs were literally just washed away. And this has, in my opinion, the ability, or at least the hope, of a lot of those people will find work again, whether it's in those textile factories or the furniture factories, which has to be good for their local economy, because right now they have nothing going on. They're desperately still trying to rebuild their lives. So I think out of this, God is providing a way to hopefully put those folks back to work, and that's got to be good for them and their families. So I want to just say praise God for that.
Yeah, praise God for that. Good thought. Yeah. I hadn't thought about that. That's a really good, wish I could have come up with that one. you're right. The devastation that has been hit over there. I mean, it's constantly rebuilding and it needed to be rebuilt, and, you know, hope this is a way that they can put those people back to work, build those towns up. And, you know, anybody that's ever been over there in that neck of the woods is just, I mean, it is some of the most beautiful. I mean, and it's beautiful to me, but maybe it's because it's so different. I mean, I have people that come out and visit from the Appalachian Mountains, and they come out and visit the Rocky Mountains, and they think this is just absolutely one of the most beautiful things that they've ever seen. And I think the same thing about going down there and going through those that neck of the woods. I think it is just beautiful to be able to see God's creation. So hopefully they can rebuild those cities and towns, because those are some of the most, you drive around those windy roads and here's a little bitty town, and they're all different and unique. And it's neat to see.
It's what those industries are, what built those towns in the beginning. And I think there's a really good chance that they'll rebuild them. So let's see what happens. That is if the enemies within our own government, because they're doing everything they can within the courts to try to stop every move this administration's making. And, I mean, that's all over the news. I don't know if y'all have been following that or not.
Yes, absolutely. And, yeah, I think
some pretty interesting stuff going on in Wisconsin, you know, for sure.
Oh, did y'all catch the governor that I don't know his name off the top of my head, at least, but I know that he came out and pretty much instructed every state employee to shield illegal aliens and not to cooperate with the federal government, and not trying to hide it. It was in a memo dated, or like, I think it was in the middle of April 18th, that he sends this memo out to, I guess, every state worker in the state of Wisconsin, and it was guidance to state workers on what to do if federal law enforcement or ICE shows up. And it was, you know, refuse to answer any questions, to deny the federal agents access to files and computers, to block them from entering non-public areas. Tell them to leave and come back. I don't know what y'all's thoughts on that, but I mean, we know we live in a divided country, but this is in your face. I mean, this is a governor of a state saying, we're not, we're not going to cooperate with the rule of law. You know, you got to remember, these guys are coming to enforce properly enacted immigration laws, and you have a state governor saying we will not comply with that. And don't get me wrong, I mean, Wisconsin's another one of those states that's just beautiful. It's a beautiful state,
yes.
But you know, they have at least in Milwaukee and that area, you know, the population areas, they have a long history of, in my opinion, communism, just the unions and their left-leaning politics. But so I don't want to speak bad against Wisconsin, because there are people in other places in Wisconsin that are just like us. But this is just in your face. You got to remember, too, this is also where the judge who got arrested for harboring or getting, you know, shielding the illegal alien that the feds had shown up to the courthouse to arrest, and, you know, and she was able to get him out of the courthouse on the side door. You know, this is that same state. And my question, I guess, in all of this is why? And I don't really have an answer. I have thought about this, but I'm going to ask you guys, because I respect y'all's opinion very much. What is the love affair? And it's not just Wisconsin, you know.
It's Colorado too. Yeah.
It's Colorado. It's Arizona. It's New Mexico. We know what happened with a judge down in New Mexico. And, you know, another article came across that, I guess, agriculture employee in Arizona, she wasn't just shielding them. She was arrested for smuggling them into the country, you know, and she's a state employee there in Arizona. My question is, why? What, in y'all's opinion, what is this love affair with bringing brown people that are not Americans into this country? Are they just that? What is the end game? And I guess I don't know if that's a good thing to talk about or not, Jason, but I have really looked at this and looked at just what seems to be the widespread nature of, it's not just a border state. It's not the states. I mean, you think of Wisconsin, do you think of Mexicans?
No,
you think
I did
of
not.
Guatemalan?
Do I
you
do
think,
not.
You know, I think of Germans drinking beer and eating cheese, you know, and I don't think of, I don't think of that. And so my question is, why in the world are they, this is the hill they're dying on of this replacement of the American population. I got my theory, you know, but, and my theory is, you know, the enemy hates us,
right,
and they just want us to not be the majority. But my question is, do you think, like, this governor of Wisconsin, does he know that, or is he just doing the bidding of someone who knows it?
Yeah, I think it's very possible. I wanted to jump back to that real quick. I mean, State of Wisconsin Department of Administration, the letter that they released, basically when dealing with the ICE, and it, just a couple bullet points real quick, refuse to answer any questions. Number one, deny agents access to paper files and computers. Number two, block agents from entering non-public areas. Demand agents sit in isolated public areas. Order agents to leave and return later. I mean, it's like, wow. I mean, this comes from the governor's office. It's like, okay, this is definitely sabotage. This is definitely war. We've got a war amongst the agencies. And in our land, and I was thinking the exact same thing. It's like I used to spend quite a bit of time up in Wisconsin. I mean, you think about fishing. There's a lake about every couple miles as you're driving down the road.
Mm-hmm.
There's a pub that's got cheese curds and German beer and fish fries on Friday nights. I love that area, and going across that, you meet some just, you know, there is good quality people up in that area, and it's like, okay, why is it that they just, you know, want them off the land? Is it they want the land? And then you're talking about them, you know, these people, this congresswoman in Arizona bringing in these illegals. It's like, okay, is it just the love of money? Is that why she's doing it? Is it bringing them in to just, you know, slave labor? Is that what it is? Or and one of the things that I was thinking about, it's like, you know, we published earlier on, later on last year, was the melting pot myth part one and part two, and how we, you know, showed that it was a myth and it was, you know, fake. And it's like, I really think that they're just, they hate the races. They hate that God made the different races. And I think that's one of the, I mean, I'm just talking about one of the things that they're warring against. They hate Jacob Israel. And I think one of their weapons of warfare is that they try to use them to, you know, get people to interbreed with one another. I mean, I know that sounds kind of crazy and outside the box, but if they can't kill us, you know, maybe breed us out of into extinction.
I'll go along with that and say, you know, and this is probably outside of my ballywick of expertise, but we know Israel is God's people. And on a genetic level, we know we were made in his image. We know we are his chosen people. As a weapon to attack that, what better way than to pollute and dilute the gene pool of Israel and to essentially mongrelize? I mean, that's what it is. It's a mongrelization of God's chosen people. And I think that's done on purpose. I think we have seen that, especially over the last 20 years. You can't turn on a television and watch a commercial. You're going to get two options. It's either going to be, well, three options, maybe. It's going to be hearing aids, a pharmaceutical ad, or some ad with a mixed couple with mixed kids, you know, romping through the park. And that is done for a reason. And that is to normalize something that is not normal, should not be normal. And I think this is an extension of that. I think the more you bring into the country from these other nations, the more likely the chances of further polluting Jacob Israel's genetic line. That's my opinion.
Yeah, I agree with that.
I think when you look at the UN charter and everything else, you know, we know that there are two sides, and there's only two sides. There's good, there's evil. I mean, I love this lie that there's shades of gray, you know. I mean, the Lord says it's either all light, or if there's any darkness in it, it's not, you know. But the UN charter basically wants this brown people all over the world. And so we look at this Bill Gates lookalike governor of Wisconsin, and what we see there is just an underdog complex of a narcissistic, you know, individual. The fact of the matter is, I think it's funny now that they're calling them illegal aliens all of a sudden. You know, there for a while during the, what do you want to call it, the evil ones reign while all this was going on, they were just, they were immigrants, you know. And I read something the other day that said, illegally entering a country makes you a citizen just about like doing a burglary or a home invasion makes you a member of the family of the people who live in that house. You know, it's like, So they do not have any rights here. I mean, if you want to extend to them basic human rights of, well, we'll feed you and clothe you while you're here until we can get rid of you, that's fine. But that's just a moral ethos that it isn't even really, I mean, they're criminals. I mean, they have done evil things. And they've broke into this, and I don't care what the reason is. That's my bottom. You know, you don't kick somebody's door down and then whine when they shoot you because you're trying to break into their house. I mean, it's like, no, they shouldn't have been there. So any way you look at it, this is an act of overt warfare against our country and against our people. I mean, it's like, no, you can't come in. You can't do that. We don't have to, and we're not going to. And, that kind of is my summary on it. And of course, the evil ones are looking at the fact that, well, we can load the ballot box. We can, you know, keep things status quo and move on from there. And the confusion that it sows into your socioeconomic situation sure doesn't hurt anything. It just keeps everything up in the air all the time, which, you know, if we're all all of the, a lot of the government employees are crisis management experts, and if they don't have a crisis, they'll create one so they can manage it. You know, so I think that's what we see.
Have y'all ever given any consideration to the quality of people, and take away the idea of just criminals? We know that. We know the insane asylums were, the doors were open and the prisons were open, but that's one category, one bucket. Let's look at everybody else that supposedly came here. You know, like you were saying, Tim, for whatever reason, let's boil it down to this, and this is harsh, but it's a thought. It's something I would like for people to think about. When you think about our nation, when you look at the United States of America, we want the best of the best, and what we're getting is a load of cowards. There are people who are unwilling to fight for what they want here in their own native country. They don't want to stand up to their government. They don't want to think make things better on their native soil. They are running here instead of standing and fighting there. What kind of Americans do you think those people will make? They will not fight here either. They're not going to stand up for what's right. They're going to go along to get along with whatever government says. And to me, that is anti the ethos of what it is to be an American. And that is what we're bringing into the gene pool. That is what we're bringing into our society and our communities all across this country. And for what I consider to be red-blooded, freedom-loving Americans, stop and think. It's not just because they're brown. It's not just because they're on our welfare. It's because they're going to come here and make more like them. And if that doesn't change America, I don't know what will. And that's one of just one reason why we shouldn't want them here. But not only are they don't look like us, they don't have our culture, they're not us to their core. Because if they were, they would have stood and fought. That's just another thought to think, I guess.
I sure agree. I mean,
undocumented Democrats.
There you go. I like that, Jason. You know, in talking about this too, you know, the last couple Saturdays we've talked about, you know, just remember there are people within our own communities. These people aren't coming in as strangers. They're coming in with support groups, you know, that are already built into these communities. And I was going to jump, Jason, because it's closer to you and Tim than it is me. But, you know, we were talking about, you know, we've been talking about governors who are in love with them, you know, judges who are in love with them, you know, and these different people from different parts of elected government or appointed government or whatever. What do you know about this club that was busted down in Colorado Springs where they ended up coming up with, what was it, 15 or 20 active duty military that were working for security inside this club? What was the story on that?
So I don't know a lot about it, but it was, I mean, it was basically, Uncle Bill sent me a news article from California, and I mean, this was right in our backyard, and it was, you know, they arrest, you know, over 100 gang members, but then there's 20 active military guys that were involved with it, and it's interesting. And I know that you know, I've heard a lot of rumors about these different military organizations and stuff, and these active military guys that have all these ties with the gang members, and that's how the drug trade is taking place. And, you know, some of the stuff, it's like, you just don't know if it's true or not, and then you try to think about it. It's like, how is that even possible? What are the logistics of that? But, the more that you dig into it, the more that it's like, you know, this is really happening.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Well, I know, go ahead, Tim, go ahead.
Well, I guess the fact of the matter is, as far as our military has went, is it's been diluted and reconstituted. You know, it's not from juice; it's reconstituted. But they've put in the trance and a lot of the other stuff. And for a while there, I was hearing rumors about the fact that even illegal aliens were being admitted in. And, of course, they threw out all of the ones who were against the jabs and everything else, you know, which kind of goes back to what Will was saying earlier about the red-blooded American people going, you know, we have an independent duty within ourselves. And, we know how to say no, congratulations. But they want to get rid of that. They just want a lot of yes people in there. And I think maybe maybe that plays into how some of that come about. But go ahead.
No, I was going to just specifically talking about these South American and Central American ties to the military, and going back to the 1980s down in Fort Benning, Georgia, there has been the School of Americas there. And I know that's been talked about before on Coffee, but this was a program that, to my knowledge, is still in effect 40 plus years later. And the School of Americas was using Special Forces, Green Berets from the United States Army, as well as the Rangers within the U.S. Army. And they were bringing in soldiers from Central America, South America, under the guise of the war on drugs. And they were going to bring them in and give them special operations training in order to interdict drugs before it came into America. And this was so incredibly successful that it set up the Sinaloa cartel's enforcement arm, which was the Las Zetas, the Zeta soldiers who were trained by our U.S. Army Rangers. They never interdicted any drugs. That, matter of fact, they opened up the avenues and the roads to bring drugs into the United States. And they're still in existence today. They are the paramilitary wing of the Sinaloa cartel, which, strangely enough, Jason, reading up on this, that nightclub that was in Colorado Springs, there was actually a member of the Sinaloa cartel that was taken into custody there in Colorado Springs. And why that's so important for people to understand that's listening to us is when we hear about these gangs, you know, whether it's TDA, the Venezuelan gangs, or the Argentinian gangs, or El Salvador and MS-13, these are just soldiers. These are just thugs that are petty criminals. You know, they may be the enforcement wing where they're breaking people's arms and murdering people and that sort of thing. And they're bad guys. Don't get me wrong. I'm not trying to minimize that at all. But when you hear that a member of the cartel was taken into custody, that's kind of a big deal.
It is. It's the upper echelon part of the food chain. It's like, okay, so somebody's in charge. It just is the way that I look at this, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it's like, okay, this really puts things into perspective on who's calling the shots here.
100%, you know, and so the way that I've been looking at this, you know, they're saying that this underground non-sanctioned nightclub, that just means they didn't pull a permit from Colorado to serve boots. I mean, that's what's going on there. But I'm going to tie this back to what I was saying with the School of Americas in Las Vegas. That's not history. That's, you know, the here and the now, because you have 15, 20 active duty military members that are acting as security for an illegal nightclub in Colorado Springs. Correct me if I'm wrong, Jason, but I think there's a couple of military bases and an Air Force academy that's in Colorado Springs. And it's so you think of the stroke and the power that you have to be able to pull these active duty military members into an illegal nightclub operation to be your bouncers. Because that's what they were. They were there providing armed security, not just bouncers, you know, checking IDs at the door. They're armed security inside this club. And you couple that with a Sinaloa cartel member being present inside the club. Well, that's the effect of 40 years ago of having the School of Americas training this paramilitary group, Las Zetas, who were directly connected to the Sinaloa cartel. Well, don't kid yourself. The recruiting in our military for these drug cartels is active. It is there. And I'm going to jump back to a news story that we had over the last couple weekends. If you can't figure out how 180,000 rounds of ammunition that belonged to the Department of Defense magically didn't go where it was supposed to and ended up inside a rental van with a couple of Mexican nationals in Fremont, Colorado, well, Fremont's not too terribly far from Colorado Springs, and it's not too terribly far from Pueblo, which was the final destination of that. So what that should tell us is there is a network operating within our U.S. military that is directly tied to these cartels. They're on the payroll of the cartels, and they're using our own people to better us as Americans. They're using our own people to their own ends. And I'm going to go out on a limb and say that may be the answer of why you have governors of Wisconsin and judges in New Mexico and judges in Wisconsin and agriculture department workers in Arizona and fill in the blank no matter where else you are in the country. That's the answer of why those people are so dead set on making sure this human smuggling continues to happen. Just one man's opinion.
Well, yeah, and I agree with you 100% and wholeheartedly. So, I mean, let's just let's think about it. So we got a bar with Venezuelan TDA, MS-13, and Hell's Angels in it. Now, I'm pretty sure that those are kind of gangs that don't get along, or at least that's what they...
Opposing forces.
Opposing forces. I mean, yeah, guys that don't like each other, guys that are supposed to be shooting each other up and stuff. And I mean, you get 100 of them, they're meeting, they're hanging out at the same bar. And it wasn't that they just all met up at there on one night. This is an ongoing deal, right? So, it stands to reason. I think it's pretty easy to stand to reason that they're doing some kind of commerce there together, trading drugs. And then you've got these military 20-30 military guys. I mean, that's a lot considering they had 100 of them that 100 immigrants that. That were arrested. That doesn't tell you how many non-immigrants were there. It was a big hopping place, and I think that it was definitely a place of commerce. And like you said, this ammo, 180,000 rounds of ammo that was supposed to get shipped to Ukraine. I think that's where originally that it was supposed to go to. And then it ended up in this van that was not rented by these Mexicans down in Colorado. There's a lot of stuff about that, but I mean, they were just the drivers. They were just, like you said, the foot soldiers. They were, given a job, and that was, take this, drive this from point A to point B. There's a lot of people, but if you or me wanted to get 180,000 rounds of 308/7.62x39 off of an armory or a military base, good luck. That had to have come from the inside. That's my opinion.
Well, absolutely. And yeah. Go ahead, Tim.
It's operational compartmentalization is what it is. I mean, put these guys in there to mule that in. They don't know anything. They can't spill the beans. They don't have any beans to spill. It was like, well, my job was to go here to there. I don't know anything else. And, it goes back to that same question of, and we've asked it before on this program, but where did all the ammo go the Postal Service and the U.S. DA, where did that all end up at? We're not talking about 1,000 rounds here. We're talking millions of rounds that were, delivered and ordered and paid for. And we haven't seen any of that show up or be liquidated or whatever. And there's definitely an asymmetric warfare component here that is running underneath or concurrently, with the administrations and with the powers that be. I mean, we're seeing that undercurrent of this stuff go on.
I'm playing the what if game here, but I think the what if game is one of the ways that we stay alive as far as mindset. And now we have evidence in our face that can't be hidden anymore. Even though it was just a 24-hour news cycle, we know about it. We're talking about it. We're keeping the story alive of 180,000 rounds of ammunition that belonged to the federal government that was supposed to be going to the Ukraine that never left, that stayed here, and we know where it was destined, in Pueblo, Colorado. If it's 180,000 rounds of ammo, what else has not made it to the Ukraine?
Exactly.
Is it the Stinger missiles You know, what is next? And we know of the black market in the Ukraine, of things getting sold back and coming back south of our border, you know, and that's one thing. But you add on top of that that, you know, we have criminals here within our own country that are doing the same thing. But, you know, I think that's something that we need to be aware of, especially in once again, this is my opinion. I'm not speaking for Tim or Jason. I'm just speaking for myself. I personally think we are moving closer and closer to a real conflict with Mexico on our border. I think there are things that are happening daily that don't make the news that I think we're moving closer and closer. It would not surprise me if we see the Trump administration attempt to take over part of northern Mexico. Due to the, you know, let us not forget that there are certain criminal street gangs and cartels that have been deemed terrorist organizations and enemies of the United States. That happened very quickly after Trump took over. And folks, that means something. That's not something you do arbitrarily. That's something that you do in preparation of some sort of action in the future. And I think that action will be a kinetic action personally. And what should scare us about that? Well, I want to back that up. I don't want to say scared. That's not the right word. What we should know about that is this amount of ordnance was moving through our country and staying in our country in places like Pueblo, Colorado. We should be mindful of the action may not all be in a foreign country. It may be right here on our soil. And the other thing I would say to that is this is not a new idea, especially when it comes from Scriptures for America. You know, Colonel Moore and Earl Jones and Pastor Peters were talking about this at camps 30, 40 years ago of these type of scenarios. And here we are now with real evidence in front of us that's making the mainstream news showing it's actually happened. And I'm going to shut up. I'm sorry. I ran off at the mouth for a minute.
No, that's all right. Keep going.
Well, we've also got a lot of tension between U.S. and Canada. I mean, there's actually some battle notations going on up there between, you know, the reality of what's going on. Who knows what happened there, but there's a lot of, you know, information about conservatives and stuff have viewed Trump's stories on Canada being the 51st state as a joke, but there's getting to be some real buildup there between them and over different things, because it's just one of those, both north and south. And I agree. I mean, did any of you guys see the little blurb on Trump talking about suspending the writ of habeas corpus due to these judges short-circuiting the, you know, deportation of these illegal aliens, and I personally, I have very mixed emotions about that, because that's one of those things that we depend on as rights, and those people aren't citizens. They don't have a writ of habeas corpus. I mean, I think
that's right.
Personally, you know, my personal opinion is that should be the approach of it. Is what you rule on that as a judge doesn't matter, because they're not citizens anyway, so they're not protected under those rights. But there's a lot of pot stirring going on right now, you know, top to bottom, and we've got a lot of our political process or our political power foundation is riddled with traitors. I mean, I think that's the right word that we have to understand on that. And so kind of back to the old fruit test again, which goes back, you know, biblically speaking, but we have a lot of people out there who have bad fruit. And it's like, well, okay, there we go. If you don't have good fruit, and if you're not, we need to adopt. And I think we're seeing that to a large degree going on right now. It's a groundswell movement, is America first. You know, we're getting back to the fact that, hey, we got to get our own house in order. We got to get things straightened up here. With what's going on. So I think we're seeing a lot of those issues.
Tim, you mentioned the judges, and did y'all catch I'm trying to pull up the story now, but I've lost it. Did you catch the this week? I think it was this week. Caroline Leavitt, the spokesperson, the White House press secretary, was pressed in a meeting with the media there about these judges being arrested by the Department of Justice. And she was asked about the Supreme Court justices of what happens if you know they do something that runs afoul, what would happen then? And without missing a beat, she said the rule of law applies to Supreme Court justices, and if they break the law, they will be arrested. And missed nothing on. Today, I caught a news story this morning, and for the life of me, I'm trying to pull it up, and I'll be very fair with you. I can't spell her name. It's the Ketanji Brown or whatever, the black Supreme Court justice that Biden put in, was in, of all places, Puerto Rico, giving some sort of speech. And so think about this. These are Supreme Court justices. They're supposed to be neutral. They're non-political. They don't give press conferences. They don't go out on the speaking circuit. She's given a speech down in Puerto Rico and starts talking about Trump as an authoritarian and being a danger to the American democracy, which made me laugh. We all know what that means. But my take on that is kind of going along with what you were talking about with these enemies, these traitors, Tim, is I think we're seeing a realigning of the traditional role that's held now for 250 years in this country. And it's not lining up in a direction that's necessarily positive when on first glance, but I think it is positive on second glance because they're coming out of the shadows and putting themselves in the light. And we really do know, where they stand. And, you know, I think that's, and I have to say this, and hopefully it's the right thing to say, is, you know, I've deer hunted a lot in my life, and it's much easier to get a bead on a deer when it's standing in an open pasture than when it's in the woods. So I think it's a good idea that, you know, this is happening. It's a good thing that this is happening, because there's no guesswork then. We know where these people stand.
Yep. They are definitely outing themselves.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and I want to I got my messenger turned on here, and I got a bunch of messages from Derek, and he starts off with Proverbs 17:23. It says, "A wicked person accepts a bribe in a secret to pervert the course of justice. The government accepts bribes. The Bible teaches it. The government people are Babylonian servants, the love of dollars. These Babylonian servants do what they can to break God's people. God laughs at them." Psalms 2, King James Version. Why do the heathen rage and the people imagine a vain thing? The kings of the earth set themselves and the rulers take counsel together against the Lord and against his anointed, saying, "Let us break their bands asunder and cast away their cords from us. He that sitteth in the heavens shall laugh. The Lord shall have them in." It all trickles up from the top. Good. Excellent points. Thank Derek for sharing that with us. Absolutely. I appreciate that. I think that we're talking about that. And I think that it ties in with some of the things that we've been talking about from church lately. And one of the started off last week with an old Richard Kelly Hoskins message, Wolf and Sheep. And it was part one. I believe that there's three parts in that series. And then I'm already working on some other stuff that Howard Freeman did on Wolf and Sheep Country. And it is, what it boils down to is, I think that there's, well, I guess taking a step back, these guys really if they could see, you know, Richard Kelly Hoskins, Howard Freeman, Jack Moore, Pete Peters, if they could see some of the stuff that is going on today, it would, I mean, I would really like to be able to pick their brains. I mean, I don't think that they would believe some of the stuff that we're actually seeing. But they at the same time, they could see so much of this stuff, you know, way ahead of time before it happened, you know. They were definitely blessed, And it's exciting to be able to see some of the things that they talked about come into pass and the stuff that they were warning us about. That wolf in sheep was just a fantastic message. And I... you know, pulling up an article here. I mean, Richard Kelly Hoskins, he wrote a book called The Wolf and the Sheep, and it's out of print now, but a fantastic book. Hopefully we'll be able to get some of those in here in the future and have those available. But, you know, he talks about just, I mean, it's plain and simple. It's, you know, wolf eat sheep. That's what they do. And talks about that. That's what they do, and that's, you know, that's what they were intended to do. You know, here in Colorado, we've been battling these reintroduction of these wolves for quite some time, and it has turned into just a mess from what they've done. And it's like, and it's so simple. You know, you introduce wolf, and wolves come to steal, kill, and destroy, and that's what they do. And you reintroduce them to a land that our forefathers worked really hard on eliminating them, because that's what they did. They killed, and you know, they've come in and they've killed cattle, and wiped out elk populations and deer populations, and you know, wolves kill for fun. They don't kill just to eat something. They kill for the joy of it. They love blood, and we're continuing to battle that here in the state of Colorado, and hopefully trying to keep them out. Thankfully that we've got a bordering state, Wyoming, that has taken them off the endangered species list, and you can shoot them at free will, and that's the way that it should be. There's, you know, people talk about, you know, the three R's, and then there's the three S's, and the three S's that people need to remember are shoot, shovel, and shut up. It's except for, you know, I wouldn't even recommend shoveling and I had to tell people, somebody was saying that the other day, and I'm like, you know, with the thing is with these collars and everything and these tracking devices that they have on these wolves, you really, is what somebody should do if somebody was going to do something, is wound them, gut shoot them, and let them run off, because you don't want to get caught with one of those on your property, that's for sure. And that might sound inhumane to a lot of people, but we're talking about a wolf, and that wolf is going to kill something, and it is, they're pure evil, especially when you're a shepherd and you love sheep.
Yep. Amen. And you know, talking about the ranchers that, in history that was protecting their cattle and their herds. You know, really what they were doing is they were making it uncomfortable for the wolves to be there. And obviously they didn't eradicate them off the face of the earth, or they wouldn't be able to be reintroduced. What the wolves did was move away. They went somewhere where the ranchers weren't. And I mean, really what we're talking about with all of this illegal immigration and, you know, talking about Dick Hoskins' book, Wolves and Sheep, is what we really should be striving to do. And what it seems like is being done now for a change within our federal government is we're just making it uncomfortable for the wolves to be here. And that is something that we all should think about in our daily lives is, you know, we shouldn't make it comfortable because wolves eat sheep. And that certainly seems like what we've been bringing across our borders is a pack of wolves. And what have they done? They've eaten the sheep. And so I don't know, Jason, about what's going on there in Colorado. I think you guys are – do y'all have a ballot? You get a vote coming up again, or how does that work?
It's going to be on the ballot. It'll be up in 2026. It'll be up on the ballot, and we'll be able to vote on it again. But basically, they want to, you know, continue to bring so many wolves in to Colorado, reintroduce them into the wildlife. And I mean, it's, you know, there was people from the Department of Wildlife that didn't even like this plan. And it was, I mean, it was just a mess. And they lied about so many things that took place in it. They didn't tell anybody where they were going to be releasing them or when they were going to release them. They might have had a release date, but they just went out there and they did it, and these things went off and started killing stuff like what wolves do. And it wasn't the people, that were up in Walden, Colorado that voted for this. That's where the farming and ranching country is. And the people that make their living off of livestock. And that's right. Where they released them. And those are the people that ended up getting the brunt of the damage. You know, they should have taken them down to Boulder, Colorado and let the wolves go downtown in their city parks or something like that. I mean, that would have been, those are the people that voted for it. Those are the people that wanted it. And seeing how that worked out.
You know, Jason, what you just described there is, those people, the tree huggers in Boulder or wherever that voted for this, those are the people that cry how much they love democracy, right? And it's because of times like this, and kind of keeping with the wolf and sheep thing, it just came to mind of, the definition of a democracy is three wolves and a sheep deciding what's for supper. And I think that fits right now,
Well, and the other thing is if you ever notice is the predators always protect the predators. I mean, when you see someone that's
exactly
really
right.
Pounding on the shepherds protect the sheep, the predators protect the predators. It's like, and we see that going on. Really, it's just a microcosm of what's going on globally. I mean, it's like, that's not.
Well,
right.
we've talked about tares and wheat. So we've got a definition. We've talked about tares and wheat. We've talked about, left and right. We've talked about them and us. I think that wolf and sheep is kind of another distinction between us and them.
Yeah, no doubt.
Yeah. There certainly are differences.
And with the three S's, Jason, if someone takes that advice with those collared wolves, maybe practice your marksmanship and try to put a round through the GPS.
Yeah.
That would be a good thing.
It would be, absolutely.
Yeah.
And very possible.
absolutely.
Yes. That's one thing that people, I think that people need to be practicing marksmanship. They need to be practicing a lot of the skills that that we talk about. We've talked about having skills and being prepared, and I guess we can go ahead and move on to prepper tip of the week. I think it's important to have the skills, but to be able to use them. Will, why don't you start off with prepper tip of the week, or we'll close out. We'll move on to that section here next.
Yeah, sure. One of the things that was we've talked about recently is mindsets and that sort of thing. And one of the things I was thinking about this week is the recent fire scare at the SFA print shop, that came out over the prayer wire that not too far, across the road from the print shop, there was a pretty good sizable fire. And that got me to thinking of, it's one thing to be prepared for a fire, to read up on how to be prepared for a fire, to have the equipment to even fight a fire. But if you haven't done it, if you haven't pulled the pin on a fire extinguisher, if you don't know how to do that, if you haven't practiced those skills, it's kind of like faith without works, that's all you're going to have. And that got me to thinking, and I visited with Jason about it, is it's good to have a prepper library. It's good to have those resources, and there's certainly a wealth of resources available from the ministry on gardening and different things. But until you've done it, all you really have is knowledge. You don't have the application of that knowledge. And I guess the conversation I'd like to have here in closing is getting y'all's opinion on is it useless to have the knowledge and not have applied it? Because in the moment of an emergency, when the balloon goes up, whether it's a fire or an active shooter or a grid down situation, like part of Europe just experienced, that's not the time to start reading an instruction manual. And I guess my thought on that is, what are some practical ways for the remnant to essentially have fire drills, right? You know, what are good ways that you can practice making fire and heating yourself and being able to apply that knowledge? And I'd just like to get y'all's take on that.
Well, I think that – go ahead, Tim. I'll let you start.
I do think it's very important to definitely have the resource materials available to you, and you definitely should attempt to read them. And in this day and age, you know, we live in a day and age of information being readily available. I mean, if you put a little bit of time in, you're not going to have any trouble finding information. Now, obviously, separating some of the good from some of the bad can be a bit of a problem if you don't have any experience. But I think the other thing is it's just like we talk about whether it's food or whether it's supplies or anything else, just because you have a lot of beans, are you going to want to eat them all the time? I mean, you know, you want to have stuff that you'd actually use in your daily life that would be useful to you, that would be helpful to you. And I think it's the same way with that. When you're getting that, those practice makes perfect. And I think that you want to use those tidbits or those gems of stuff you find in your daily life. Figure out a way to, it's just very important to have that mindset to figure out a way to work that into your life. And, you know, that teaches your children by use and by daily rote that those things are, that's the reason you do that. You know, don't, there's a whole list, I mean, a book really, or books of how you can do that, and definitely needs to be part of what we do daily as far as that goes. And I think that having it, I think Jason said that last week, but I'm a big book fan. I don't have any problem with, and I do. I have USB sticks. I have different things that have immense amounts of information on them. But if there's no power and if there's no computer, they border on useless to me. But I can sure read a book. So I still have them backed up in that way, because how else can you do it? And the other thing is I think have friends and neighbors that having the same thing gives you a backup. You know, I mean, I think that's another important aspect of it as far as being able to keep that information around. So, and it's a constant gathering thing. I mean, I've been doing this my whole life, and I'm still finding things I want, you know, that belong in there, that need to be added. So that's my two cents.
No, and I agree with both you men on that, and I think having the information is definitely a good thing, but applying it and knowing how to use it is equally as important. Like, you know, Tim, you were talking about the food and the beans and this and that. I mean, I don't know how many times I've seen people that have went out and spent thousands and thousands of dollars on these prepackaged emergency Patriot food, and, you know, my question is, have you tried it? Do you like it? Are you going to eat it? It's like, seriously, it's like some of that stuff tastes like, I mean, it tastes pretty darn bad. And it's loaded with soy, and it's going to plug you up. And it's like, okay, yes. Is it going to keep you alive? Absolutely. I mean, you could eat it, and it would. But you might not feel good when you eat that garbage either.
Right.
Just something to think about. I encourage people to, you know, number one is have the foods that you eat that you're normally used to eating, and you know, stock it up and rotate it. To me, that is practical survival food storage. I like rotating stock. I got those racks that go in the pantry that you put the can. They're a Coke machine. You put the new cans on the top and you pull the old cans out of the bottom. And it's a simple, easy way to, you know, rotate canned goods. And I think that those are phenomenal. They're cheap. They used to be, you know, they used to not even be able to buy them. Now I think you can get them off of Amazon. But to me, that is practical food storage. Buy the stuff when, buy good, you know, we try to buy good organic canned goods when it's on sale. Most of the places, like even our Whole Foods, if you buy stuff, if you're going in and buy a case of green beans, they give you pretty good discount on a case price. Not saying that I want to support the evil empire of Whole Foods or anything like that, but you can talk to places and you can do that. You can do it and you can have stuff that you would use on a normal basis. And I know, I mean, I'm not going to get into the aluminum in the cans and this and that. I mean, you know, I understand that. To me, that's a lot better than, you know, having a bunch of stuff that's going to be a shelf stable for 25 years that's going to taste like garbage and you're not going to eat it anyway. And you're going to feel like crap when you do eat it because your body is not used to eating it. That's putting something into practice and just, you know, being aware of. You know, I think everything, and it's, you know, I've got three young boys that love to they love to thinking about survival and camping and outdoor stuff, and we practice building fires. And it's, you know, it's building a fire. Sometimes it's, you know, building a fire in wet conditions. Sometimes it's building a fire in windy conditions, learning how to do that. But it's things that if you don't practice, you're not just going to know. You can have an idea, of how you're going to do it. But it's a lot easier to know how to do it ahead of time before you're wet and you're cold and you're trying to start a fire. It's a lot easier to learn that skill now and to hone that skill versus when, you know, you've gotten your body soaked to death and it's 20 below zero out here and you're trying to save your life you're going to revert back to your training. You're going to revert back to the skills that you put into practice. And I encourage people to, you know, try different things, think about different things. It's one thing, like you said, Will, is to have that library, to have that information. I was thinking about the fires and the fire situation that was coming through, and it's like, you know, I got a library, and it's, if my library's gone, I'm going to lose a lot of really good, valuable information. And I think that the best information that we can have is the information that's in our minds and in our brains. The stuff that we have put in to learning skills, to practicing those skills. And it's one thing to learn about it, to read about it. There are certain things that you can read about and you can, obtain the information, and you don't have to go practice it to make it work. You can, if with a little bit of ingenuity, you can lock that away and put it in a storage filing cabinet in your brain, and you know the mechanics of it, you know how it works, and you can put it into action. There's other things that, you know, sharpening a knife or, you know, starting a fire, purifying your water, learning how does your water filter work. It's, you know, when you're dying of thirst is not the time to be reading the instruction manual, trying to figure out how to assemble your water filter. That's just my two cents. The other thing is Tim, I like how you think about putting stuff on the USB sticks. I've got a lot of information stuck away on hard drives, USB sticks, that are in, you know, watertight containers that I can access. But I mean, I can have that, but there might not be electricity. There might not be internet. You've got to think about a lot of different things as far as that goes too. But I think another very important skill is learning how to go to the manual and get the information out of it. You know, it's one thing to have a whole library, but knowing where those books are, knowing how to go to it, knowing how to find the information is another thing. Yeah. There's, you know, it's like reading a shop manual is the way that I look at it. Is if you don't know how to read, that shop manual ain't going to do you any good. If you don't know how to use the glossary or how to go to that shop manual and find the section on what you're trying to do, it ain't going to do you a bit of good. It's like sitting on a hill of beans. I really think that, you know, learning how to go to, how to find the information, how to obtain it. I've got a lot of books that I have not read from cover to cover, books on survival, books on, the Foxfire books are just a phenomenal series of books that, talk about a lot of different skills, a lot of skills that are lost. And, Will, why don't you tell us a little bit about the Foxfire books? You know, you're familiar with those and you know the history of them a lot better than I do, but I think that it was basically from the 70s, maybe earlier than that, but it was just stuff that was people recognized that was being lost.
Yeah, the Foxfire book, the Foxfire School is actually what was founded first, and it was founded by a gentleman named Elliot Wigginton up in the area of around Young Harris, Georgia, in the Appalachian Mountains. And the idea behind this of the school was it was a school for school age children in that area. That focused a lot on journalism and writing. That's how the genesis of it. And what that grew into was a student project of interviewing kind of the old timers, the grandparents of these kids up there in northern Georgia, and they started cataloging the old ways. And it initially came out as a magazine, Foxfire magazine, and it is anything you can think of. Jason is 100% correct as far as a chronicle or a series of primitive skills of farming and furniture making, and I mean anything you can think of.
If you want to butcher a hog or build a still,
yeah,
it's in there.
Or make a garden, or you know, shoe a mule. You know, anything you can think of, they captured, and they did it in first person accounts. So this wasn't theory. You know, this wasn't someone sitting behind a desk researching, you know, on the internet of this is how you're supposed to do it. These were interviews with people that had lived their life this way. This was not theory. These were the skills that had been put in action. And it's just a great resource. And the Foxfire Project is still alive today. It's now ran by the University of Georgia. And the Foxfire School is still in existence there in Young Harris. But it is a neat collection. I highly recommend people look into it. There's some videos you can find online on YouTube and other places that detail it. But one of the things that became unfashionable a generation ago was, you know, these backwards old people. They didn't know what they were doing. We had to embrace the modern ways. And there is certainly there are modern things that I'm all for, you know, as far as technology is concerned, but that doesn't mean that we flush the old ways down the toilet, you know, that they still have their place. And we should know those things. First off, generationally, it's how we keep our people's history alive. Secondly, just like what happened in Portugal and France, you never know when you may have to call on those old ways to get through 24, 48, 72 hours or longer. So that is something certainly we need to embrace as a people. It kept our people alive for a long time. It's probably a good knowledge set to have.
I agree. And yeah. Go ahead, Tim.
What we can do at this particular moment is largely based upon the technological yardstick we have available to us. I mean, you know, if you want to mix some food together, an electric mixer is just great as long as you have electricity. I mean, but, you know, if you don't, that's probably not going to be your go-to. So there's things in there. There's things in those books, and I have them. I've read them and maybe not cover to cover, but definitely have been through them. But it's a wonderful backup for that. Okay, how would they have done this, you know, 100 years ago when they didn't have these widgets or whatever, you know, and you can go back and do a little, so pretty interesting stuff.
Yeah, and I think that's just one series of books, but it's a series of books that I got on my bookshelf that I know what those books contain, and if I need information on one of the subjects in there, I know where to find it. And so I think that's kind of what you know, what we've been talking about, prepper tip of the week. Being able to have the information, go to it, get to it, and being able to use it. I think that it is very important to have, you know, the life-saving skills are the ones that, you know, I mean, how to you know, build yourself, how to in an emergency shelter is something that, you know, people need to think about, and how to get a fire going. To me, those are, you know, two things: how to get to your food and how to get your water. Those are the basics, and I think that people need to start with the basics. A lot of times people, you know, want to jump way ahead They don't want to learn the basic skills. They want to learn the more advanced skills. And it's, you know, the basic stuff that's going to keep you
alive. They want to be that guy on the YouTube video.
Yes, yeah. Yes, exactly. Yeah, and exactly. And there's a lot of phenomenal guys out there that got some really good ideas. I mean, and I'm not knocking them by any means. Yes, you know, continue to push yourself and learn skills and gain skills and do different things. But, you know, learn the basics. Go ahead.
I got one just quick thing to say. I know we're getting long here, and I just want to say it's just a quick thing, and that is this. One of the greatest ways we can combat fear is confidence, and having confidence in whatever the situation is if you know you're equipped, you know you have those skills, you have the mindset that you've played this scenario over in your head, and you're confident that you can push through to the other side. It doesn't matter if it's a flat tire on the side of the highway. You know, if you know you have a good spare, you have a lug nut wrench and a jack, and you've practiced this before, this is just a bump in the road, and you can get back underway. It's that way with anything in life. You know, if you're properly equipped and you have the skill set and you're comfortable with the skill set, that builds confidence. And confidence is one of the greatest weapons against fear. And one of the things that we talk about here is being free of fear, freedom of fear. That's not what we're peddling. And so I guess just in talking about this, that's kind of what was in my heart, Jason, is what we're really talking about is no matter what you have, know how to use it and know when to apply it. And if you can apply that equipment and those skills and that knowledge, you will find yourself not being afraid. And that I've said it before, and I'll say it again just because it's one of my most favorite quotes, and that was Clint Smith from Thunder Ranch when he was asked, are you so paranoid that you have to carry a gun all the time? And he said, why would I be paranoid? I carry a gun all the time. And that's kind of what I'm thinking about here is what we're really talking about is the freedom of fear. And that comes with confidence, knowing that you have the skill set and that you can apply them appropriately. And I just wanted that to be said.
I agree. And I think that is definitely good information. And I think that's worthy of, we can leave that topic and close out with that, because I don't think we can top that. Can we, Tim?
No, that's awesome.
We did get long-winded today, and we are just about out of time, but I did want to go ahead and talk to people or tell people that, thank you for liking, sharing, subscribing to Rumble, Spotify. It's exciting. We've got a lot of shares on there, got a lot of people that are tuning in, and we've got a new audience, so that is encouraging. Also, we've got a couple new things that have been going on with church. We launched our church bulletin, online church bulletin, virtual church bulletin, I guess is what you could call it, a couple of weeks ago. So get me your email address if you'd be like to get that. We do have a mailing list. We do send out periodic. We try not to send too much stuff where it's a burden to people and it's garbage. But we try to send out good information. We send out our church bulletin, occasional updates on stuff that we've got going on here in the ministry. You can email me, jason@sfaw.org. That's jason@sfaw.org. And shoot me an email. I'd like to hear from you. I'd like to hear from where people are listening in, how they're tuning in. And if you don't mind, let me know if you're listening in on Spotify, Rumble, on our website. Our website is scriptures4america.org. Do appreciate hearing from people, and appreciate you men taking the time to be here this morning. We had a good show, and definitely appreciate the time and the effort that everybody puts in to make these things possible. And do just want to continue to encourage people to pray for America, pray for the salvation of America, and check us out at the website, sfawbn.com or sfaw.org.